This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My goal is to really take you from what you'd learn on the first day of your first chemistry class in college all the way to the frontiers of human knowledge and what my group works on a week-to-week basis here at Scripps. So it's going to be a fast ride, so buckle your seatbelts. Before digging into the science, I want to share one secret to success, at least as I've found it, in scientific research. And to me, the secret ingredient is the people. And when we think about people and science and the face of science, I think the public generally thinks it looks like this. But at least in my experience in science, the face of science looks much more like this. I work with an awesome group of about 14 people, men and women, human and canine, people as young as high school interns to as seasoned as doctoral, postdoctoral researchers. And people who hail from all around the world, from right here in Southern California to as far away as Germany and Japan to perhaps the hailing from one of the most foreign lands of them all, Texas, and everywhere in between. And this is really the best part about working in science, is working with a really diverse group of people who are united in sharing a love of scientific discovery and having the opportunity to learn from people who know more than you, who are smarter than you, and really just engaging in this wonderful discourse that moves human knowledge forward. Okay, we're going to start today with a pop quiz to get your cognitive juices flowing. And this is actually the same pop quiz that I was given on my first day of organic chemistry as a freshman at the University of Michigan, I guess now roughly 13 years ago. And it's a very simple question. What does this symbol mean? And I'm going to need volunteers, otherwise I'm going to cold call on you, and nobody likes that. Okay, I see a hand in the upper left here, this young gentleman.
Delta.
So this young gentleman is saying this could represent the Greek letter delta. Very good. Any other ideas? Yeah. Change, yes. So this young lady is suggesting this means change. This is actually related to the previous answer. So delta can be a symbol for change that is used in various fields of science. Any other ideas?
Energy,
okay. So delta G, delta S, delta H are all energy terms or change in energy terms. Okay, these are all great responses. And as you've probably gathered, this is a little bit of a trick question because there's no one right answer. This symbol could mean a triangle. Specifically, it could mean an equilateral triangle. It could mean the Greek letter delta, which has relevance in mathematics, which in turn has relevance in physics. Or it could be some symbolic representation of signs that we encounter more commonly in our daily life. Or if you're musically inclined, you might recognize the symbol in a different context. Or it could mean this strange-looking molecule called a cyclopropane. And so the point is that the symbolism and the meaning that it implies is really dependent on the context in which you're using it. And so I think part of learning science is learning the language of the field in which you're working on. And so we'll try to build up your fluency in the language of synthetic chemistry as we go through the talk today. Okay, so very quickly, a brief outline of today's talk. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the field of organic chemistry is, why I think it's important, why I've devoted my professional life to studying the mysteries of this field. And one of the key takeaways keep coming back to again and again throughout today's talk is the intimate relationship between molecular structure, molecular properties, and ultimately function. And that is not only true in chemistry, it's really true of many branches of science, that structure dictates properties, dictates function. So I'll keep coming back to that point again and again. Then we'll talk about why, what this is good for. What is this knowledge useful for practically in society, in your daily life? And lastly, I'll conclude with talking about what my group works on. Okay, so let's jump in. I'm going to need your help again. What is organic chemistry? Or what do you know right now about organic chemistry? Any ideas? Yeah. Reactions, properties. Yeah, very good. Any other ideas? Yeah, in the back. Carbon-based life forms. Very good. Other ideas? Have you heard anything about organic chemistry? Oh, yeah, one over here. Properties of biotic factors and environments. Okay. And have you heard anything about organic chemistry as a class in college? Have you heard any good things? Have you heard any bad things? I take it from the laughter that you may have heard something. So in doing extensive background research for today's talk, I did what I normally do, which is do a Google search first. And you see, it's pretty interesting. So the second most popular hit is this one here. And so everyone can see that before organic exam, after organic exam. So if you don't get that joke, come see me in a couple years' time when you're in college. Here's another one. Keep calm. It's only organic chemistry. So I think what a lot of these images allude to is the preconception in the public that organic chemistry is extremely difficult class, that it's a weeder class for medical school, that it requires an inordinate amount of rote memorization. And, you know, to be honest, I'll leave it to you to make your own determination about how you feel about this class when the time comes. But for me, it has been this wonderful marriage of the logical rigor of mathematics with the freedom for creative expression of painting. It's right in the middle. It allows you to both be an inventor and an explorer and a philosopher. So it's been infinitely fascinating to me, and I hope to be able to share and convey that passion to you today. The definition of organic chemistry is very simple, actually. It's just the chemistry of molecules that contain at least one carbon atom. So carbon-based molecules are organic molecules. And you'll hear me use a lot of different terminology throughout the talk that all kind of refers to the same thing: compound, molecule, product, substrate. It's all sort of the same thing as just a molecule that contains at least one carbon atom. And organic chemistry is important because it really affects pretty much every facet of your life. Carbon-based molecules are ubiquitous in modern society, from fragrances to living life forms, living organisms, as well as chemicals that we've developed to sustain those living organisms, pharmaceutical agents, as well as plastics. So you can see that you can't even enter a room in a household without encountering some organic molecule. And one of the central principles underlying organic chemistry is something called the octet rule. And very simply, it states that, generally speaking, atoms tend to favor arrangements where they have 8 electrons in their valence shell. And so that's important because it tells us something about bonding. So if we want to predict how many bonds a given atom might want to have or might have in its favorable configuration, we just turn to our handy-dandy periodic table and just count from left to right. 1, 2, 3, 4. Carbon has 4 valence electrons. It brings 4 electrons to the table, which means to form a stable octet, it's going to need to get 4 electrons. And as a consequence, carbon normally, in its stable, most stable form, has four bonds. So I'll illustrate that with a very simple example. That this is a molecule that maybe some of you are familiar with, carbon dioxide. You have carbon drawn in the middle here. Its four electrons are represented in black. And you have two atoms of oxygen flanking carbon. Oxygen, if you go to the periodic table, has six electrons. So it shares two of those electrons with carbon on each side. And then each pair of electrons is a covalent bond, which we represent with a line here. So this is one representation, and this is arguably a slightly simpler representation. Anytime you see a bond, that represents two electrons. And in this case, these non-bonding lone pairs are implied to be present, even though they're not drawn. So those are that's the basics. And how do we get from there to here? So this is a picture of the wall in my office as of last night. And some of you might be looking at this and thinking, well, I may as well be looking at this. Because I cannot get any meaning out of what is on the wall. They just look like hieroglyphics. So just like the Rosetta Stone has allowed us to obtain meaning from hieroglyphics, I want today to equip you with your own Rosetta Stone to derive meaning from these molecular hieroglyphics, so that at the very least you can look at them and know what chemicals each of these structures represents. And so I'm going to illustrate how to construct and deconstruct molecular hieroglyphics with a few examples. And I'm again going to need your help. So we're going to start with a molecule called octane. Has anybody heard of this molecule before? Or is anybody familiar with an everyday substance that contains octane as a principal component? I see a hand in the back.
Gasoline,
very good. Excellent. And this is a two-dimensional representation of the structure of octane following the rules that I outlined previously. Octane has molecular formula C8H18. It's a string of carbons all connected in a line. Every carbon forms four bonds. In the case of these middle carbons, that means two bonds to carbon, two bonds to hydrogen. Hydrogen actually doesn't follow even though it's sort of the most common atom that you encounter in organic molecules, it doesn't follow the octet rule. It requires only two electrons to be stable in its valence shell, so that's why you see only one bond. Remember, each bond represents two electrons, so every carbon atom is following the octet rule in this case. This is one way to represent the structure of this molecule, but you might argue there are some shortcomings. One is that this is a two-dimensional representation, but molecules all have three dimensions. And also, this is a little bit cumbersome, right? If every time I wanted to communicate with one of my students about the molecule octane and I had to draw this out, I would get like carpal tunnel in my wrists. So let me make two changes to this. One, I'm going to now draw this in 3D. So carbon does not actually form four bonds in a square planar arrangement. It forms its four bonds in a tetrahedron because a tetrahedron is the shape that that allows for the maximum distance between four points on a sphere. So each of these squares, instead, we draw as a tetrahedron because that's how it actually exists. And then we make a change where instead of drawing the letter C every time we see a carbon, we say, okay, we get the point, there's carbon there. Let's just let this corner or this intersection of lines represent a carbon. And you see now it adopts this staggered type of molecular conformation. And then you could say, well, this is still very cumbersome to draw. I don't want to go into this field of study if I've got to draw these all day long. So let's make one more simplification. And every time we see a carbon-hydrogen bond, let's take it as implied that it's there. So we don't draw that. And we get to a relatively simple representation of this more complex molecular structure. I think If I asked you if you had to draw this 100 times or this 100 times, you'd choose this. And organic chemists are no different. We've invented this shorthand, you know, just like when you're writing, you're text messaging your friends, you say, you know, you don't say, "Do not come over," you say, "Don't come over," because it's faster and easier to communicate. And so that's what chemists have invented. This is molecular shorthand for this. Let's move on to the second example, acetone. Has anybody encountered this molecule in their life? I see a hand here. Indeed, very good. Nail polish remover. It has a molecular formula C3H6O. Now we have a little twist here. We have an oxygen atom. We learned previously that oxygen stably forms two bonds. So let's see how this molecule looks in this two-dimensional representation, following the same rules. Now again, just like with octane, we've got these what are called methyl groups on the end, carbon bonded to three hydrogen atoms. And now in the middle, we have a carbon-oxygen double bond that's called a ketone. And let's apply the same manner of simplification that we did previously. So now we draw this in a way where the carbon, the letter C is removed to make it a little simpler, and we draw it in three dimensions. And then lastly, we take every carbon-hydrogen bond as implied, unless specified otherwise, and we get to a relatively simple representation that you could all quickly scrawl out. This is the molecular shorthand for acetone. Okay, last example. I think you guys are getting the point of how this works. Acetyl salicylic acid. It's a tongue twister. You should. Has anyone encountered this molecule in their lives? I'm sure you have, but maybe you don't recognize the name. Okay, I'll give it away. It's aspirin. This is the 2D representation. The molecular formula for acetylsalicylic acid is C9H8O4. There are some new functional groups here. This is a carboxylic acid. This is an ester. And now we have six carbon atoms in a ring with alternating double bonds. This is called an aromatic ring, and it has some special properties because the electrons in this bond are actually delocalized. Let's apply the same reasoning we did before to this molecule. Now, the aromatic ring is actually flat, so the 3D representation is not that interesting, but you see it is quite a bit simplifying, and then without the H atoms, we get to this here, which is the molecular shorthand for aspirin. Okay, so that the previous couple slides, I've tried to give you the basic, as I said, Rosetta Stone for how to derive meaning from these different molecular representations of organic molecules. And now I'm going to transition to talk about how the structure affects the properties of these molecules. And again, I think, like in many different aspects of science, don't get bogged down in the details. You know, you don't necessarily need to understand every little point. Just sort of focus on the big picture message that I'll be trying to communicate. So there are many different types of intermolecular interactions. So intermolecular, just like intercollegiate, inter means between two different things. So intermolecular just means between two molecules. And there are many different types of intermolecular interactions. So previously, what we talked about are covalent bonds between atoms. And those arrangements of atoms make up molecules. And then molecules interact with other molecules via intermolecular interactions. There are many types, as I said. Here are three very common ones: hydrogen bonding, dipole-dipole interactions, and van der Waals forces. The details here aren't so important. What's important to appreciate is, as you've maybe learned in your high school chemistry class, every atom has its own unique properties. And one such property is called electronegativity, how much it pulls electrons towards its nucleus. Oxygen has a higher electronegativity than carbon, so this carbon-carbon double bond becomes polarized in this direction. Most of the electron density resides here on oxygen. And then just like magnets, aligned appropriately, there's an attractive interaction between one face of the molecule, the positively charged face of the molecule, and the negatively charged face, just like magnets. Hydrogen bonding is just a special type of dipole-dipole interactions, and van der Waals forces is just a weaker type of dipole-dipole interactions that is induced because there's no strong electronegativity difference in the atoms. But again, the point is just there are many different ways in which molecules can interact, and the molecular structure dictates how these interactions, the nature and type of these interactions. So another way to think of that is by analogy. As I said, a molecule structure dictates its interactions with other molecules. It dictates how it will behave in a crowd. So one case is how it will behave in a crowd of similar molecules. So as we can take this as a case study, a stormtrooper is very disciplined and well-trained. And so in a crowd of other stormtroopers, it sits in this nice arrangement. They're well-schooled. Although, despite their training, they seem to not be very good at shooting, at least in the movies. It's not very accurate. And compare that to this. So we have the professional soldiers here, and now these are just trainees. You see, now the lines are not quite as tight. They're a little bit more disorganized because they're still learning the ropes. So again, from the professional interactions are very strong. Now you have trainees. The interactions are still strong, but a little weaker. Now you have a completely different phenotype. You've got a businessmen, and you see they have strong interactions, but a different kind of interaction. The businessmen don't want to stand front to back. They all want to be staggered to have their own space. So they arrange in a very different sort of pattern. So you see the patterns are very different. And then, some molecules like to party, and their interactions are completely crazy. Hard to predict, very free-flowing. So you see, the takeaway message is that the behavior of the crowd is somehow predictable, or at least understandable, based on the properties of the individual components. Although some crowds, the behavior is not always clear, and sometimes people struggle to understand. Okay, so let's talk about now how these general ideas apply in practice. So these are the three molecules that we covered before, N-octane, acetone, and aspirin. These are the molecular formulas. We talked about some intermolecular interactions that they might have. And that then manifests itself in terms of their physical properties. So two examples of physical properties, melting point and boiling point. Let's see how those change as a function of structure. So in the case of N-octane, the melting point is minus 57 degrees Celsius. The boiling point is 125 degrees. That means that it's a liquid at room temperature. And of course, that is important for its applications as a fuel. Acetone, similarly, has a relatively low melting point, slightly lower than octane, negative 95 degrees Celsius, and a boiling point that's a little higher, 133. Again, as you know from removing your nail polish, the acetone is a liquid at room temperature. And aspirin has a much higher melting point. You see a big jump here. And actually, it doesn't really boil because at the temperature that it would boil, it starts to decompose. So this has a high melting point and is a solid at room temperature. So these are what these compounds look like. Again, the structure dictates the types of interactions, and then those interactions dictate what physical properties that molecule has when it's interacting with itself or other molecules of the same type, and that in turn dictates what kinds of applications you could think about using it. So that's one type of situation where a molecule is interacting with molecules of a similar type. But there's also a situation where a molecule is interacting with molecules of a different type. And that's probably the more common situation in nature, because it's very rare that you have something totally pure in nature. If you think about a cell, it's a concoction of a ton of different chemicals. And so understanding this in a predictable fashion is also also important. So to illustrate that, one context in which the interaction between a molecule and another molecule or another class of molecules is important is binding of an organic substrate to an enzyme in the active site. And whether the equilibrium is favorable this way or this way, whether the shape is a good match here, whether having these electron withdrawing groups here polarizes this in the right way to fit in this enzyme's interior. Just one, as I said, just one representative example of how an interaction between a molecule and different types of molecules is important. What this really boils down to, and this actually, I have to say, this took me a long time to really fully appreciate, because to me, when I was a high school student, I was always taught chemistry was chemistry and biology was biology. And though this might sort of sound naive to admit, I never really made the connection that biology is really just chemistry. And all of these weird shapes that you see in biology are actually just organic molecules. DNA base pairs have a well-defined structure linked together through hydrogen bonding. Similarly, when DNA is transcribed to RNA, RNA is an information coding system similar to DNA and again is held together by hydrogen bonds between base pairs. And proteins are just a bunch of amide bonds in a row with different substituents off of the bridging carbon atom. So all of biology really boils down to complicated chemistry. And because we just learned that the property of an organic molecule dictates how it will interact with other organic molecules, this also translates to biology. So a molecule structure will dictate how it interacts in a biological system. And this has profound relevance for human health. So as the example we've been talking about is aspirin. Aspirin has its particular molecular structure, and that it interacts with all the biomolecules in your body in such a way that it has this effect of thinning your blood, which can treat the symptom of a headache. And really all that comes down to chemistry and intermolecular interactions. It's just a profound, profound connection. So how is this useful? Or what is it useful for? I just alluded to it, which is you can then begin to build up this system of understanding that correlates a molecule's structure to more complex function. So this is a little bit of a complicated example, so I don't want you to get lost in the details. But it's an example I took from a recent paper in from the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry. And basically, what it's saying is one property that's important to understand about a molecule is how it interacts with membranes. You guys have probably learned about membranes in your biology class because membranes are found ubiquitously in biology. And so previously, people had understood there to be a specific relationship between the size of a molecule, how many carbon atoms it has, and how likely it was to cross the membrane. But these investigators set out and uncovered that at least with these molecules, which are called macrocycles because they have a big loop, it's a very different relationship. Actually, these do not cross membranes nearly as well as it would be predicted based on current knowledge. So again, I don't want us to get too bogged down in the details, but suffice to say, there is an understandable and perhaps predictable relationship between molecular structure and function, even in complex biological phenomena like passing through a membrane. And so understanding these relationships is crucial for designing drugs. There are many different examples I could give here. I just picked one. This is a specific enzyme that is relevant to leukemia. So in cancer, some enzymes work too hard, some enzymes are too lazy, and that causes the whole cell to go haywire and divide too fast and cause tragic consequences. So one strategy that scientists have pursued is to discover molecules that can interact with these enzymes and make them work harder, or, you know, for the lazy ones, they can kick them in the butt and get them working, and for the ones that are too excited, to help calm them down and not make things go crazy. And so it's all about having a molecule that has the right shape and the right properties to fit efficiently in the middle of the enzyme. And so how is this done in practice? So you have an enzyme, you know it's important to cancer. So what people do is, first you ask your neighborhood robot to screen 1 million molecules and see which of those 1 million molecules is the best. And the ones that are the best are called leads. And then those leads, you make as many analogs as you can very quickly. And by asking questions like, if I change this methyl group to an ethyl group, what happens? You start to understand the relationship between structure and activity. That allows you to then make more analogs. And hopefully at the end of this process, you end up with the drug. So it's a very simplified version of this process of drug discovery. So it begins with identifying and using techniques from biology, both structural biology and molecular biology, to identify an enzyme that might be a candidate for treating with small molecules, and then scanning structural space to find good fits, changing those in predictable ways, and seeing how that affects activity. And so now we're going to start to transition to what my group does and how we impact this overall process. So this, it turns out this part is really hard, making a lot of analogs in a quick manner, and quickly elucidating these structure activity relationships and then making more analogs. So there are a couple problems, as you might appreciate. This is one, and then this other problem of who has 1 million compounds lying around in their backyard. Turns out only big drug companies. So there's this problem of making a lot of initial compounds quickly, and then once you have a hit, making analogs quickly. And that all comes down to the synthesis of these specific candidates. So we'll come back to that in a slide or two, but I just want to highlight how this looks like in practice. So here was one of their leads, and you can see this is just an arrangement of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, nothing different than what we looked at before. And then you can start asking questions like, if instead of a cyclohexyl group, this were a cyclopentyl group, would that make it better at inhibiting the enzyme or worse? And in this case, they asked the following question. What happens, here's oxygen, and R just refers to any generic carbon-based group. So any alkyl substituent is R2. They asked the question, what happens when I change this to every conceivable shape and level of polarity and level of greasiness? How does that affect activity? And it turns out, it has a profound effect. So you can see, oh, here's one of our familiar triangles, a cyclopropane that you guys learned about on the earlier in the presentation. So you can see just making these subtle changes, like from 12 to 16B, replacing one carbon-hydrogen bond, again, not drawn, with a new carbon-carbon bond, has a fairly substantial effect on the activity. IC50 is just a means of measuring how strongly these compounds inhibit the enzyme. And you can see you go all the way from quite potent to essentially non-reactive with just very small molecular edits. So this is like an analogy to being a surgeon at the molecular level. Be able to make very small, precise changes and then understand at a very deep level how those changes affect function. And so obviously this approach to designing and improving medicines has been tremendously impactful. Sometimes, as I mentioned, those initial leads come from what we call high-throughput screening, testing a million compounds you have lying around. Sometimes we go to natural sources, so maybe traditional medicines, figure out what the active ingredient is, and then use that for inspiration of making our analogs. There are different approaches, but the important thing is that this approach of using synthetic chemistry to make these molecular edits to improve potency or lifetime has a proven track record of success. And none of these medicines, including treatment of symptoms, as I said, aspirin for inflammation or headaches, and treatment of disease states would exist without this practice of synthesis of molecules, building molecules from scratch. And this is really what my group here at Scripps focuses on. We recognize that this process of making analogs very quickly is sometimes time-consuming, particularly when those analogs are structurally complex. And so we want to invent new reactions to streamline this process so that there are more compounds initially going into these high-throughput screens, and then that the process of doing derivatization is much faster. And as a as an underlying motivation, we want to do this in a way that's sustainable so that we can make all the molecules we want while having as small an impact on the environment as possible. We're motivated not only by curiosity, but because our research has what we think are profound implications. And so to illustrate that, I have just included this quote from Elias Zerhouni. He was formerly a director of the National Institutes of Health. And one of his flagship programs is called the Pathways to Biomedical Research. And as part of evaluating whether this program was successful, he surveyed a bunch of participants and asked them a simple question. What's the roadblock in your research? What is the rate-limiting step? Why is biomedical research take so long, and why does it take so long to discover new drugs? And he assumed it would be something like problems in computational power and structural biology, difficulty in identifying druggable targets, and was quite surprised to find that what he heard most was difficulties with synthetic organic chemistry. Specifically, being able to make structurally complex molecules like this. You see, going from octane to these kinds of molecules, that's a quantum leap in molecular complexity. Making molecules of this type quickly, efficiently, is a huge unsolved problem. So that problem is what keeps us, people in my group, up at night. But of course, it's important if you're working on a problem that keeps you up at night, that you also have something to get you up in the morning. So that gets us out of bed, but then what gets us to work is the notion that we can make an impact on this problem through developing new synthetic methods, and specifically catalytic methods. So you might know that a catalyst is an additive to a reaction that lowers the activation energy. So a reaction that otherwise would be prohibitively energy intensive can happen relatively easily and quickly and be recycled and used over and over again. And so that's where the connection to sustainability comes in. And specifically, we rely on the unique reactivity of the transition metals. The transition metals are just this part of the periodic table. Specifically, we focus here, this is called the catalytic triad, a very dramatic name. And this space of the periodic table is very interesting to explore because unlike up here, you have now the presence of d orbitals. And so atoms from here interact with atoms from here very differently than main group atoms interact with each other. And the consequence of that is that modes of bond construction and deconstruction, the act of stitching together atoms, can be done in a very different way when you're using these kinds of catalysts than when you're dealing with only atoms from the main group. And so this is a general depiction of what this process of molecular construction looks like. The title of my talk was The Nuts and Bolts of Building Molecules. So this is what that looks like. I showed on previous slides many different structures of varying levels of complexity that are drug molecules. And you may be asking this question, where do these come from? These are all made through chemical synthesis. Sometimes these processes can take as many as 40 steps. Often, by step I mean an individual chemical reaction, often they take at least 10. And eventually, if you backtrack from that final product to ask what they're made out of, it's simple starting materials that are made from either petroleum feedstocks or ideally from renewable feedstocks. And then there's this question of how do you stitch these simple starting materials that you can order from a chemical supplier together in a way to generate complex products. So very similar to how do you go from a steel beam to a skyscraper. And so the way we think of it is, you know, if your goal is to build this, a molecule with this level of complexity or a skyscraper that reaches that high into the evening sky, you're not going to get there using this. You need state-of-the-art building equipment, state-of-the-art tools that are sleek, modern, and efficient in order to build complex structures. So my group develops state-of-the-art tools to supplant existing tools so that we can streamline the synthesis of drugs and drug-like molecules from, you know, as I said, 40 steps in extreme cases down to manageable amounts, like fewer than 10 steps. And now I'll jump a little bit more into the specifics, not so much with the expectation that all the details will be clear to you, but to just get so you get a little bit of a flavor of how we think about problems and how we think about inventing new reactions. So we look at existing drug compounds and think about structural motifs. Structural motif is just some pattern of atoms connected together. One that we've recognized as very common in many, many different types of drug molecules and other interesting molecules are what are called vicinal functional groups. That just means two carbon atoms connected together, and each of the carbons has some other group sticking off of it, including a nitrogen atom or an oxygen atom. So again, this corner just represents a carbon. This corner represents a carbon. There's an implicit hydrogen there, and then each of those carbons has a hetero atom, which is nitrogen in this case, oxygen in this case. We look at that and say, maybe we could make all of these from very simple starting material. Carbon-carbon double bond. This is one of the cheapest starting materials that you can get. And it's available both from renewables, as I have drawn here, as well as from petroleum-based feedstocks. And so we want to develop a technique where we can convert these ubiquitous starting materials to drug-like building blocks and use a catalyst from the catalytic triad that allows us to program in which group goes there. So again, molecular surgery, where we can install with precision one group at this position and one group at this position. One of the reactions that we've worked on is and made some progress on recently is this deceptively simple-looking reaction I have drawn here. So I think you guys, just from this lecture alone, can already understand what is going on here. So you have a carbon-carbon double bond. Remember, implicit H atoms there. A nitrogen-hydrogen bond. And the question is, can we somehow add this nitrogen here and this H atom here? It's very simple on paper, and it would not be unreasonable, even in your first year organic chemistry class, to draw something like this and think that you could do it. But there's a big problem, and it all has to do with this principle I mentioned previously, which is dipoles and the distribution of electrons. So a carbon-carbon double bond has a pi bond with a lot of electrons, big cloud of electrons. And this nitrogen atom has an implicit lone pair. Nitrogen has three bonds and then one lone pair. Also, big cloud of electrons. And if you just try to run this into this, it's like having two magnets run into each other the wrong way around. You just cannot get them to connect. So we just use a little dash of a transition metal to pull electrons out of this pi cloud so that the lone pair there can attack right in. That allows us to form a new carbon metal bond. As you can imagine, that's very reactive, and that reacts then with H atom from a co-catalyst. and delivers our product. And importantly, consistent with this notion of catalysis, the metal can then be recycled and keep going around again and again and again. So we only need a very little bit of this to get the whole thing to work. It's like when you're cooking, you just need a dash of salt. If you too salty is not good, but it's amazing what just a dash of salt does. Same sort of thing, just a little bit, and it makes the whole cycle turn over. And so we were able to invent a new reaction to accomplish this historically challenging transformation. And one of the co-inventors is seated here in the front row, John Gurek, who's pictured here. And this is a celebratory dinner after we made this discovery and disclosed our results. And one of the things that's important about this is that it allows us to take relatively simple starting materials and quickly map them into drug-like building blocks, in this case, analogs of the bioactive compound GABA, which has established anti-anxiety properties in terms of its biological activity. And we can make all new sorts of analogs and then team up with some of the biological folks here at Scripps and next door at Caliber and start to ask questions about whether any of these analogs have improved performance relative to GABA. So one of the things that we try to do in our lab is invent chemistry, invent techniques that are so simple that anybody can do them anywhere. It's no good if you're trying to develop a new tool, but the only people who can use that tool are experts with specialized training. We want to be able to develop tools that we can distribute to anybody, that they can use no matter where they are. So this is what the reaction actually looks like. These are all of the components drawn out here. The alkene starting material is an oil. Succinamide, which is just the NH. I told you we have to add nitrogen, so this is the nitrogen. Here it's a white solid. Benzoic acid is a promoter, co-catalyst. It's a white solid here. Palladium acetate, that's our magic dash of salt, is this interesting looking orange solid here. And acetonitrile is a solvent that just helps everything mix together efficiently. And so I'll show you how this reaction works. So this is what that looks like, a close-up. This is a picture of it heating, and you see the reaction time is 4 hours. And after 4 hours, then it looks like this. There's a dramatic color change, but not one that is impressive. It just turns into this black gunk. But inside despite the ugly appearance, actually something very productive happened. So after we've done this reaction, the next question we want to ask is, did it work? Did we accomplish this reaction that we wanted to? And you can use many techniques to answer that question. One that we rely on commonly is called NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance. So we take a small drop of the reaction solution and then dilute it with a special solvent into a vial like this. This is a photo taken by our high school intern / hand model, Jessica, who worked with us this summer. And then we put this tube into this machine, which contains a very strong magnet. And the magnet is controlled by a computer, and the computer tells the magnet to exhibit a very strong pulse. And that creates an excitation of a particular spin, and then that spin decays in a way that can be monitored. So this is analogous to taking a big mallet and hitting a bell, listening to what that bell sounds like, and then inferring something about the structure of the bell. So it's very high pitched, and that's probably a thin bell. If it is low, it's low pitched, then you can imagine maybe it's a Liberty Bell or a gong or something like that. But the frequency in which it's vibrating tells you something about structure. So that's the same technique here. This is what that experiment looks like. Details here are not so important, except to say that this is like a molecular fingerprint. To the trained eye, this tells you a ton of information about what this compound is and what functional groups are present, how all the atoms are connected. So, for example, this carbon-carbon double bond we can characterize as being present because of these two signals. And then we run the reaction and watch what happens. Whoa, they're gone. Oof, very efficient. So those signals are gone, and now we have new signals down here which correspond to the group that we tried to put in. So that reaction worked. But you see, even though the reaction is pretty efficient, there are some extra parts that we don't want. We just want this pure product so we can test it to see if it's a good drug compound or for other purposes. So we have to purify it. And once we've cleaned it up, this is what it looks like. Very nice spectrum. You see now these groups are present down here. And we purify it using a separatory funnel, a column. A column is a way of separating molecules based on their polarity, based on how strong of a dipole moment they have. That's very common in organic chemistry. And then when it comes off the column, we remove all of the volatile solvent, so we get pure material left. And then lastly, we dry it on the what's called a Schlenk line. We just apply high vacuum to really remove all of the volatile stuff so that we get pure product in the end. So in this case, this particular reaction gives a white solid. But as you know, because structure affects properties, we have other cases. If we use a different nitrogen source, we can get an orange solid like this. And you guys can look at how these products look. I think it's quite cool. And then after we made this discovery and found out that it was pretty general, we could make lots of interesting compounds, then we wrote this up in a publication so that we can share what we learned with the rest of the world. So this is where I think truly the analogy to being an explorer really holds true. We went into a foreign part of human knowledge, a frontier that had not been explored. We figured out something new about what that world looked like, and then we wrote back to the rest of the chemistry world to tell them about what we found. Okay, I am going to wrap things up by coming back to this slide and reminding everybody about why we do this and why we think it's important. We're driven both by curiosity and also a broader sense of purpose about helping human society. And we've recognized that one of the ways in which we can do that is inventing new methods to make complex molecules to enable downstream biology and medicine. So we think there's a huge opportunity by doing this to have a major impact. And lastly, I'll just again thank the awesome team of people I work with, some of whom are here today. Andrew, who introduced me, John, who's helping out as well. It's a true privilege to work with such a motivated, brilliant team of folks, as well as a very talented psychologist and mascot here. And you see that, you know, we involve, I don't have a photo here, but we involve young people in research. And that's true of a lot of laboratories, people who are undergrads and people who are even as young as high school students. So it's really, you know, if you want to pursue a career in science, there's a place for you. And I just encourage you to be proactive about looking for opportunities. So that's it for my talk. Thank you again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.